We have a bad projector, so you can only see half my slides, which is going to make this kind of difficult. But hopefully they'll send someone in here to fix the projector or give me a new one. But I'm going to be talking about intelligent I/O capabilities for Linux, specifically the I2O software architecture. How many people here have heard of I2O before? Okay, well, yes, I know Alan has. How many people here are familiar with how it works or have looked at the spec at all? Not many, just Alan over there. So basically what I'm going to do is give you an overview of I2O. But I'm going to give you an overview of I2O, an overview of the Linux I2O implementation, and then some little talk about the future directions of intelligent I/O, and just open up for questions. I'm not going to try to give you excruciating detail about how I2O works. The I2O spec is about 300 pages long, and it would be like a two-day class to explain it to you. So I'm just going to give you enough of an overview architecturally of how it works and some basic understanding of the concepts about how it works, and then jump into the Linux implementation. So take a break while they try to get this working. I'll take the resolution down again, try it. Same thing. Yeah, 640 by 480. It's still. Okay, so a little background on why I2O exists. Basically, if we look at today's computing environment, you're probably quite aware of this already. Everything is very client-server oriented. You have web servers, file servers. Can you? All right, let me try. Are they just... not clear, or?
No, it's just...
Oh, oops. Okay. Here. That's all right. One moment. Is that better? Okay. Sorry about that. So, yes, today's computing environment, client server, web servers, streaming media servers, large databases, large database-backed websites, Lots of clients, lots of servers. This leads to very heavy I/O loads on servers. You've got servers, you know, that are serving huge Star Wars movie files to thousands of people across the world. And this is only going to get worse. More people are getting online. There's going to be greater broadband deployment. You know, at least where I live, broadband is getting to be in every neighborhood. And there's going to be increased content on the internet. More movies online, more digital audio online, just, you know, more data. So you're going to have even higher I/O loads on these servers. And the conjecture I have is that today's servers, they can't handle this I/O load. The way they're architected, the way they're designed, they just cannot handle this without getting overloaded. This is basically what a server looks like today. You've got, you know, a processor, a chipset, Northbridge is generally what we call them, connected to some system memory, a PCI, you're beginning to see PCIX-based servers now, PCI bus hanging off the chipset, and you've got your I/O devices. And what happens with this kind of system is that every time there's an I/O completion, there's an interrupt that's being sent to the processor. And the processor now has to stop what it's doing. It has to go out across the PCI bus and read some sort of status register on this device to complete the I/O transaction. And basically, every time you have to read across a PCI bus, you have to, if you've got writes, they're pending on your PCI bridge, all those writes have to be flushed before the read can go through. So your CPU has to sit there and wait for that to happen. And testing has shown in labs that if you're running at 1,000 BT, so gigabit Ethernet connection, you can't get gigabit Ethernet. The best I've heard is about 700 megabits a second, and that's using 100% of the CPU, and most of that time is being used just processing interrupts. So, you know, if you've got this really fast processor, it's going to be spending most of your time processing interrupts instead of processing application data. And that's not what you want. Another problem with today's I/O subsystems is that almost all I/O is going to go through system memory. Let's say a user requests a file, you know, file.mov from a server, and that file isn't currently cached in memory. That file is going to be read off of disk into system RAM, and it's going to be taken from system RAM over the network. So you're going to be taking this huge file and streaming it across your PCI bus and your memory bus twice, when really you don't need to do that, and you're just wasting that bandwidth that could be used for other data. So with that in mind, a couple of years ago, I think 1993, several companies in the industry, Intel, Compaq, Microsoft, IBM, all the big players got together and realized this was going to become a problem. It wasn't a problem yet in 1993, but they realized over the next couple of years it would become a problem. So they decided to come up with this thing called the Intelligent I/O Architecture, commonly referred to as I2O. And the primary purpose of this was to reduce CPU utilization for I/O processing. And this was done by basically what you do is you hang off a separate I/O processor in your system that handles your low-level I/O details. And basically this allows your CPU to only worry about data processing and not about low-level I/O processing. And let me just show you what a picture of an I2O system. Basically, we've still got the PCI bus, but instead of having the I/O devices hanging directly off that PCI bus, we have a secondary processor called an I/O processor that's running down there. The I/O processor has its own memory, as it has its own sort of permanent storage device, either flash or EEPROM or something else. Normally, it's just flash. And then you have another PCI bus hanging off of that, and your I/O devices all come off the secondary PCI bus. And what happens is your I/O processor runs its own little real-time operating system, which, you know, it's called an I2O real-time operating system, an RTOS. And basically, the bulk of the I/O work is done by the I/O processor. And what happens is as interrupts come in to the I/O processor, it can coalesce them into a single interrupt to the CPU. And communication between the IOP and the host processor is done through messages. So what happens is, let's say you've got 10 network packets come in. The I/O processor can wait until all those 10 network packets have been received, punch them all up into a single message, and send one single interrupt to the CPU. So the CPU doesn't have to get bothered by all these interrupts. It can only be bothered by one interrupt every once in a while. So I want to talk a little about I2O messages, what they look like, how they get transmitted between the processor and the CPU, and because that's really the bulk of the specification is understanding how do these messages work and how do they get transferred between the CPU and the IOP. Basically, the I2O specification defines a bunch of abstract messages for different classes of I/O devices. You know, standard I/O devices you would have on a server. LAN, such as Ethernet, Token Ring, ATM, random block storage, which is basically disks and CDs, sequential block storage, which is tape, and then you can also have generic SCSI devices, which would be things like scanners and, you know, non-storage devices connected to your SCSI bus. And what happens is that your driver is now split across your CPU and your IOP. Normally, you have a device driver sitting up in your processor that knows all the low-level details of your hardware. With an I2O subsystem, your driver on your host processor doesn't have to know how the hardware works. It just needs to know how to talk at this I2O messaging layer. And I'm just going to show you a picture of that. Basically, if you can read that. Can you read that in the back? You've got this ERTOS, which is the I2O real-time operating system. And the hardware in this case is an Intel A255X network chip. And you've got an A255X HDM. HDM is a hardware device module. It's a device driver that runs down on the IOP. And up on your CPU, you've got your network stack, and you've got this LAN operating system module. And OSM is the upper half of the device driver. And basically, oops, never mind. The communication between the LAN OSM and the device driver down the bottom is done through these I2O messages. And I'm going to go into detail what those messages actually look like in a few slides. So the CPU itself doesn't care what the hardware is down there. You could replace that Intel chip with a DEC chip, and as long as there's a driver available to run on the ERTOS down there, the CPU doesn't have no low-level details. And that may not sound too exciting right now, but once I get into a little more detail how this can be used, you'll see why it's kind of interesting. Basically, there are two types of messages in I2O subsystem. You've got messages that go from the IOP back to the CPU, and these are called outbound messages. Everything in I2O is from the point of view of the IOP, not from the point of view of the host. So outbound messages go from the IOP to the CPU. Inbound messages go from the CPU back to the IOP. Outbound messages are all stored in system RAM. So the IOP will build a message in system memory, and when it's done building a message, it will inform the CPU there's this message there for you to read. Inbound messages are built in IOP RAM, and when the CPU is done building a message, it will inform the IOP that there's a message you need to read and do something with. I'm just going to sort of walk you through how this works. Basically, you've got IOP memory, system memory, and this middle section right here is all implemented as hardware in the IOP. And there are four queues. There's an inbound free queue, an inbound post queue, an outbound free queue, and an outbound post queue. At system boot up time, the host operating system, Linux, will allocate a bunch of message frames in system memory for the IOP to send messages back to the CPU. The message frame size is user configurable. Like right now under Linux, we use 128 byte, I think. But you can just change it as a pound define to use larger size messages if you want larger transactions. The I2O operating system running on the IOP will allocate a bunch of message frames in IOP memory. And it'll feed these into this thing called the inbound free queue. And then once the host is done allocating those messages, it will send all those messages, it'll send message pointers basically, over to the I2O operating system, and it will feed those into this outbound free queue, which is a queue of messages that can still be used for communications. Now let's say the host processor wants to send a message down to the IOP. It'll read that pointer off of the top of the queue. Once it's done reading that pointer, it will build a message, you know, that pointer was pointing to that memory right there. So it'll build the message either directly in IOP RAM through PCI IO, or what it'll do is it'll build it in system RAM and then do a memcopy to IO across the PCI bus into the IOP memory. Once it's done, it'll take that message pointer and write it to the inbound post queue. And that writing that message pointer to that post queue causes an interrupt on the IOP. So the IOP now goes and reads that pointer. It performs the task that's requested by that message, and when it's done with that message, it puts it back in the free queue so that the CPU can use it again. If you're running from the IOP's point of view, and the IOP wants to send a message to the host, it's the exact opposite. It would read the top of the outbound free queue, build a message in IOP RAM, DMA it over to system RAM, and then it would post that message pointer into the outbound POST queue and send an interrupt to the CPU. And the CPU can just read that message pointer. So how does this whole thing get initialized? Well, basically, CPU boots up. It sends an initialization message to the IOP. The IOP is going to scan the secondary PCI bus for devices. And like I showed you before in that picture, attached to the I/O processor is a little flash, piece of flash or EEPROM, some other sort of permanent storage device. And you actually have device drivers embedded in that flash. And each device driver has a PCI device, vendor ID and device ID associated with it. So as it's scanning the bus, if it finds a device that has a driver associated with it stored in permanent memory, it'll load that driver from flash into the IOP's RAM and execute it. The device driver will then go through and create an I2O device object for each device it can control. And once all the devices are initialized, the CPU can start communicating with these devices. And I'll go into more detail of this as we go along. It'll make more sense. So let's say I've got an I2O controller, and behind this is an Intel A2559 network chip. So the system boots up. It sees that it's an A2559 chip. It loads my A2559 driver. My A2559 driver in the IOP creates an object for that device. And along with that object creates something called a logical configuration table entry. Basically, the LCT is just this table of all the devices that are sitting behind I/O processor. And with each, the main thing to remember is that with each LCT entry, there's a unique ID associated with that. And we're going to come back to that. That's how you target a message to a specific device behind the IOP. And the I2O operating system itself is always ID 0. So anytime you want to send a message to the OS itself that's running on the I/O processor, you send a message to target ID 0. And the system processor is always target ID 1. So if the CPU, if the IOP is sending a reply back to the CPU, it's always going to say it's going to target ID 1. And like I said, the IDs are used to target a message. And I'm going to show you what a message looks like, and that'll sort of put all of this into context. So the CPU is going to build a message to send down to the IOP. The fields that really matter are in red. The other fields, I left them out of this because they're really not that important. The size tells you basically size of the message in bytes. The function is what is the function this message is requesting. For example, I'm sending a message to a LAN class device running on this I/O processor, and I want it to send a packet. And that, would be hex 3B. So if you put a hex 3B in there, it means send this LAN packet. Source is the ID of the object that's initiating the message. And target is the ID of the device that's going to receive that message. So if it's being sent from the CPU to the IOP, the source is always going to be 1, and the target will be the target number of the LAN device. And then initiator context and transaction context, they're used as cookies, so when the OS gets a reply back from this message, it knows what transaction it's associated with. Now, when I talk about the Linux implementation a little, I'll show you how that's used under Linux. And the message payload is actually the data for the message. An example message would be something like this. This is a LAN packet send message. It's got, the size doesn't matter. You know, it's going from the host, which is target 1, to ID 5. So 5 happens to be a LAN device sitting behind this I/O processor. The initiator context and transaction context, we don't care about right now. And after the message payload is basically a bunch of pointer and size pairs. So you've got 15.14 and a pointer to a LAN packet, 15.14 pointer to another LAN packet, 15.14 pointer to a third LAN packet. So you send a single message down to the I/O processor, and the LAN device now takes and DMAs those 3 packets across the PCI bus out to the network. And that's all done through a single message, a single write across the PCI bus to the I/O message queue. What are some of the other I2O features? I2O provides platform-independent device configuration. Let's say you've got an Intel network card behind this I/O processor and a DEC network card behind this I/O processor. Both of them can be configured using the same commands. There's basically I2O provides something called parameter groups for the device classes. For example, LAN has parameter groups that let you set the LAN speed, the duplex setting, another LAN, like multicast group, that sort of thing. Things that are associated with a LAN device. All LAN devices are going to have those settings. for like a storage device, you can have things like cache policies. Is it going to be a write-through cache or write-back cache? You know, what is the cache timing going to be like? And it's got an HTML-based configuration system. And I wish I had a demo box here, but I couldn't get one because it's sort of hard to explain without really seeing it. But basically, each device that's running on the IOP in flash memory has a bunch of HTML pages stored in it. And what happens if you want to configure this device, you just run a web browser and you have some sort of CGI script that sits between your web server and your I2O and your I2O driver layer. And you can just type in a URL like, www.machine.toplevel.domain/ the number of the IOP / device. So let's say IOP, you have one IOP only, so IOP 0, that same network device, device 5, page 0. That would take you to the home page for this network device. And what that allows you to do is allows you to have a configuration system that's completely OS independent. We can take the network card. When I worked on this stuff, we were actually working on a RAID card. We took this RAID card, plugged it into Linux, plugged it into Windows, plugged it into SCO. Question?
What HTML does it use?
Oh, right now I think it's 3.0. But it's really, the problem is that's up to the end, up to the developer of the driver.
So it's really IE specific?
No. It actually works better in Netscape, and we have problems getting it to work under IE. At least the but we're able to take the same card, plug it into Windows, SCO, Novell, Linux, and Solaris. And we were able to use a web browser to configure it. We didn't have to have an OS-specific configuration tool, which means that when you develop a card, you now don't have to develop driver. You don't have to develop configuration tools for every single OS. You just develop the single configuration interface through HTML, and it works. You look like you have a question.
What did you use as CGI across all these architectures?
That is architecture-specific, and that's part of the driver stack. You know, for Windows, there's something called IOP.exe, and for Linux, the University of Helsinki developed an IOP. I think it's called IOP or either just I2O is the CGI script. It's a really simple CGI because the interface is very simple. It's basically one message that says, give me this page from this device, and then it has a pointer to a buffer in memory where the HTML gets sent to, and if you have forms, it has a pointer to a second buffer which contains the query data. Yeah, so like, basically each one has its own CGI script, but that's a very trivial CGI script to write. You know, I wrote it in Perl once and it was like less than 15 lines. It's a very simple thing to do. The other feature is dynamic device support, which I'm not going to go into very much right now. I'll come back to that later, towards the end if I have time. The final feature is I2O events. Basically, I2O is a master-slave environment as of now. The version 2.0 of the spec changes that, but version 1.5 of the spec, which is what everyone is using right now, is a master-slave environment. The CPU can only do requests, and the IOP can only reply. And IOP can't just send a message to the CPU for no reason whatsoever, unless it's gotten a request from the CPU first for a reply message. And normally, one request equals one reply. Yes, and that's one of the things that was fixed in the 2.0 spec. I'm on the steering committee thing for part of the 2.0 spec, and one of the things we said was, well, we need to change this. It wasn't actually changed in 2.0, but when I get down towards the end, I'm going to talk about this new thing called the socket class, where they're offloading the whole TCP stack down to an I/O processor. And for that, we realized, well, you can't do master-slave. You have to have the IOP be able to say, here's data from the network, you know, otherwise, it doesn't make very much sense. It makes sense for things like storage, because you're not going to just give data to the CPU unless the CPU says read data from the disk, right? With the model it was designed in mind, it made sense, but it doesn't. It's not as useful without having a real, a peer-to-peer relationship, which is being added also. But to get around this one request, one reply thing, I2O has this concept of events, which are basically requests where you can make one request and get multiple replies back. So you can register for these events, these little bit masks, and each class has its own set of events. For example, a LAN device has events like link up, link down, speed change. You know, a block storage device has media mount, media unmount, media lock. And you know, the OS itself has events such as device error, you know, memory error, memory parity error, IOP failure, that sort of thing. So I'm going to now jump into the Linux I2 architecture, and I'm going to come back to some of those little points I made earlier and try to explain them a little more now that I talked about implementation. Basically, the Linux I2 architecture is developed of 7 different modules. They can all be compiled in statically. It works in the 2.4 kernel, and it was ported back to 2.2.1.6, I believe. And basically, the components are as follow. The I2O PCI module basically provides low-level PCI access to the I2O devices. I2O Core, it basically provides I2O initialization, and it provides an abstract API, not really an API, interface for class-specific modules to use when talking to I2O subsystem. So there are certain common tasks that there's no point in having every driver rebuild these messages. You just have some sort of API that does it. And then I2O LAN, block, and SCSI are class-specific device drivers. And then I2O proc provides a /proc interface to I2O subsystem for debugging purposes mainly. And I2O config provides user space access to I2O. And I'm going to go into detail into each of these a little. But I'm going to start with just basic initialization. How does an OSM get loaded? How does the system get loaded? Basically, first thing that happens is I2O PCI.O gets loaded into memory. It scans the PCI bus looking for I2O controllers, which is basically PCI class E, subclass 0. There's also a subclass 1, which is I2O controllers that don't have interrupts. They can only be pulled. Right now, we don't support those. It's been on our list for a while. Once it finds the device, it IO remaps the first base address register into kernel virtual address spaces, requests the interrupt lines, and set up these pointers for these queues. Basically, you know, you remapped some portion of hardware into memory, and these queues are located at the offsets into this memory space. Once all IOPs have been found by the PCI subsystem, the control is passed to the core module. Basically, the core module allocates memory for the messages, and I should say outbound messages, because the messages from the IOP to the CPU. Right now, we allocate 128 messages per IOP, but again, that's user configurable through pound define. And messages are currently 128 bytes apiece, but again, that's user configurable. We did some testing while I was working on this where we had used 512 byte messages, and we're able to get some really amazing throughput. It creates a couple of kernel threads to handle some events that need kernel threads to handle them. And then it creates, it scans all the IOPs for the logical configuration tables. So it knows what devices are sitting behind this IO processor and builds a table of all I2O devices. And once that's done, class-specific device drivers can be loaded. So now let's say you're a block storage, you're the I2O block device driver. You control I2O block storage devices. When you get loaded, first thing you do is you register yourself with the core using this I2O register handler function call. When you do this, the core assigns you a unique identification number, which is used later. I'll show you how that's used in a little while. And then as part of that registration function, you include a function pointer table, which has pointers for functions that all OSMs must support. And once it's registered itself, the OSM will scan the I2O device table, and if it finds a device it can control, it's going to call this I2O claim device function, say, I'm going to be controlling this device. And I didn't have a picture of what the LCT looks like. Basically, the LCT is just, it's a table that has a bunch of ID, it has an ID, and it has a class field. A class field is a 32-bit field, which basically has predefined codes for different classes. Once the device has been claimed, the OSM can start communicating with it using class-specific messages. And I'm not going to go into the class-specific messages. I gave you the example of LAN class message. The spec is available for free download if you really want to look at it, or you can just look at the code afterwards just to get an idea of what a message will look like. To send a message down to an IOP, the OSM builds a message bound for the device, and then calls I2O post message to send it. I2O post message basically takes that message and writes the pointer into the outbound queue. When it's posting a message, it sets the initiator context field, which was that cookie field I talked about a couple of slides ago, to that ID that was assigned earlier. So it posts this message, the IOP gets it, the IOP processes the message. When it's done processing a request, it sends back a reply. The ITO spec requires that when a reply is sent back, those cookie fields are not changed. So the core now gets this reply message. It looks at that cookie field, and the cookie is sent to the ID that was initially assigned to this handler. So it now looks at its OSM table with the ID and knows who requires this reply. So it sends this reply back to that specific driver. Now, messages in ITO are asynchronous. You send a message, and you'll get a reply at some other time. And there's no guaranteed ordering in messages, because within the IOP itself, there's a scheduler running. Different objects have different thread priorities. So you have no idea when that reply is going to get back. But there are times when you want to force synchronous behavior. For example, there's a message called BSA flush disk, which basically says flush this block, flush the cache in this block storage device. Or it is like BSA media lock, which basically says lock this media device. You don't want that to be asynchronous. If someone says flush this disk, you don't want to return to them until you flush that disk. So you want to somehow force that synchronous behavior. And the core provides this ITO post wait interface, where you basically call it with a message, and then the core writes this message to the outbound queue, and then it puts the calling thread to sleep by calling sleep on interruptible timeout. And as part of that post-wait function call is a timeout associated. You know, normally less than 5 seconds is what I've used, except for there's some cases in initialization. When initializing the system, you want to initialize things in a specific order. And there's some initialization tasks that can take up to 2 minutes. If you've got, 50 disks behind the ITO controller, they all have to be brought up, and the RAID system has to be brought up, it's going to take you a little time to bring that up. So when booting up an ITO subsystem, ITO-based computer, it can take a little while to boot up. And then when the reply is received, the thread is woken up, and if there's no reply received in the timeout that was given, you get an E timed out. Dynamic device support. I sort of skimmed over that. I just mentioned it. I didn't really talk about what it means. Basically, since ITO abstracts the whole IO subsystem, you can create and delete devices dynamically while our system is booting. And I really wish I had a system here to show this to you. But basically, let's say you've got an IOP, and you've got a SCSI controller behind that. And behind the SCSI controller, you've got 10 SCSI disks. And you've got them set up as two different RAID volumes. And you're running your system, and you decide, well, I actually want there to be only one RAID volume. So using this browser, you could go in, you could say, I want to delete this RAID volume, and I create a new RAID volume while the system's still running. And with the way the Linux OSM is implemented, you can actually immediately access that. So what happens if you have ITO HDA and ITO HDB, and you delete those two volumes, those disappear. If you try to mount them, you'll just get an error saying devices not exist. And then when you create a new device, it'll get recreated as ITO HDA. And it's really kind of neat to see it actually working, and I wish I had a demo that I could show you. Basically, this is just a list of the functions that the OSM provides, that the core provides to device drivers. You can query parameters, scalar values. Basically, parameters are either scalar or table. A scalar value is something like the network speed. It's either 10 or it's 100 or it can be a gigabit. Table values are things basically where you have multiple values for the same setting. An example of that is multicast groups for network cards. A network card can belong to multiple multicast groups. And then event register and unregister. So you basically tell the system, I want to get this event from this ITO subsystem. Posting messages, and then registering and unregistering a device driver. Really quick status. ITO block provides dev/ITO/HD*interface, and basically it's major number 80. There's 16 devices max, with 16 partitions per device maximum. It supports the 2.3 and 2.4 request queue interfaces. So when a request gets queued up, we have our own queuing functions that we call, and the reason we do that is because Linux will give you all block requests in 512K byte chunks, but we can coalesce those into page size transfers, which is better for ITO because you can just say, here's a pointer to a whole 4K chunk instead of having a bunch of smaller pointers. Did you have a question? It supports dynamic device creation, which I just talked about. You can create and delete RAID volumes as you're running, and they'll get added, they'll get deleted. And it boots up. You know, you can boot using an ITO device, either using initrd, or you can have it actually compile statically into the kernel, and it works great. I don't really have any real benchmarks yet, because I'm no longer working with the stuff, and right now the focus is on getting all the functionality out of the way, and there's still a couple little bugs here and there. So once those are out of the way, I think there'll be some real benchmark numbers. Hopefully they'll get published. ITO LAN supports 10 base T, 100 base T, 1000 base T, token ring, fiber channel. It running at gigabit speeds, it achieves almost the same throughput as native, but it decreased CPU utilization. So they're definitely in the right direction. One of the problems right now is that, you know, the same problem that would happen with gigabit Ethernet, the CPU was getting overloaded. Now this I/O processor is getting overloaded. So now you're going to have a fast I/O processor. And there are definitely issues with that. ITO config, it provides, like I said, it provides a set of ioctl commands for use for user space applications that want to talk to the ITO subsystem, so basically configuration tools. You know, it's a dev slash dev slash ITO slash control, major number 10, minor number 160. And basically you can get the number of IOPs in the system. You can return ITO LCT get, basically it returns the list of devices on that system. ITO param set param get, it lets you set and change parameters. ITO EVT reg lets you register for an event. ITO EVT get retrieves an event. So basically you register for an event, event comes through, it gets put into this queue for your file handle, and you can call this other ioctl to retrieve this event. But you can also get asynchronous notification by using the fasync function call, and then what happens when an event comes in, you'll get a SIGIO, and then you call the same ioctl to get the event off the queue. And then ITO HTML is basically how you access an HTML configuration page. Some of the advantages and disadvantages of ITO. ITO does reduce number of interrupts, amount of CPU time spent on processing. Like I said, there are no Linux benchmarks yet, but it's been proven across three different operating systems. I really shouldn't probably say their names. And then it increases PCI bus efficiency because you are now getting higher, you're getting burst transactions across the PCI bus when you communicate between I/O and CPU. You're bursting these big messages across instead of just doing, you know, small reads and writes, so that's going to increase your efficiency. And, you know, one of the nice points is OS independent hardware support. Like I said, if you have an ITO stack and you have an ITO card, you plug that into any operating system that supports that class, and it works. And once that driver has been written to support that class, you don't need to change that driver. One of the major disadvantages, and this is something we found out when developing ITO LAN drivers, was that there is definitely a lot of latency. You have to build this message, and then you have to send it down the bus, and then it has to be parsed. You know, it's broken apart by the I/O processor driver that's running down there. For things like disk, that's not a problem. Your disk is already so slow that, you know, the latency is not a big issue. But when you're dealing with network packets, especially as your network packets get smaller, the overhead becomes very large, and your performance really drops as you get towards smaller packet sizes. And there's some things being done to deal with some of these issues. So I'm just going to talk a little about future directions of intelligent I/O, specifically ITO, and then some other things. First thing that's going to be done, I think, in the next couple of months is the Linux ITO stack will get support for ITO version 2.0. And the two major advantages of 2.0 is it supports this pull model instead of what's called a push model. Right now, the CPU builds a message, and it has to write it to IOP memory into these message queues. And so it has to push the message from system RAM to IOP RAM. The pull model basically allows the CPU to build a message up here in system RAM and then write a pointer into the queue, and then the IOP itself will DMA that message. So the CPU has to spend a lot less time chunking the message down across the PCI bus. And then the other thing is support for 64-bit pointers for things like IA64. Socket class. This is probably the most interesting thing that's happening with ITO right now. I was working on this until a few months ago. Basically, a couple members of the ITO SIG are taking the whole TCP/IP stack and moving it from the processor down to the IOP. And basically, the reason this is being done is for things like gigabit Ethernet. Basically, so the CPU can now just send, instead of sending, you know, these little network size, little MTU-sized chunks, it can just say, here's a 64K packet, here's a pointer to it, send it to this socket address. And the IOP manages all the fragmentation, the checksumming, and everything else is associated with TCP/IP. And when it's done sending that packet, it sends a single interrupt to the CPU saying, this packet is done. We have it, well, I'm not working that anymore, but it's working under other operating systems, and it's shown incredibly good performance. The Linux OSM development has just started. I just met with them last week, and they're just finishing up the design. And it'll be released to the community, and hopefully they'll actually develop it concurrently with the community by talking to, you know, some of the people who are doing the TCP/IP stack work for Linux to make sure that they can integrate it into a system so you can have a native stack and you can have an I2O stack running at the same time. The socket class specification is going to be available publicly on the web in about 3 months is what I heard. So if you want to actually take a look at how this works and how you would actually, you know, have TCP/IP stack running down to ILP, I'll have you the URL at the end of this presentation. So, you know, really quick, dumb animation. You know, standard system user application, you have a socket interface, an IP stack, and you have this I2O LAN device driver. So basically you're moving that, so you have the socket interface talking directly to the driver, which talks down to the I2O subsystem. The other feature that's being worked on is peer-to-peer support, and this allows you to set up direct I/O transactions between IOPs. So you could have something like two network cards, packet comes in, and they forward them directly between each other using I2O. And the other interesting application is hostless backup. You tell this tape drive, go back up this disk, they both talk I2O, the host doesn't have to be bothered until the tape backup is complete. And, you know, this is a possible really long-term application. I know, you know, you can look at this thing and say there are a lot of problems with this. Yes, there are a lot of problems with doing something like this. But this is, you know, a really long-term application where things might be headed. Let's say you have a CPU and you have this block storage device, like a RAID array. But instead of just having block storage support, this thing can actually offload a whole file system. It knows what a file looks like. And you can just directly send a message saying, give me this file, not give me this block. Now, you have this intelligent network device running with, like, a network processor that has some basic understanding of HTTP transfers. A user sends in a request to the server saying, I want this file. Question? King. Okay. User sends in this request saying, I want this file. You know, the request is going to go up to the web server running on the CPU, but the web server is going to realize this file is static. I don't need to touch it. I'm not going to do anything with data. All I would do with this data is read it and then write it back out. So I'd just be bouncing it across system memory. So it could set up a transaction between this intelligent network device and this intelligent storage device so that the network device could directly read the data off of the disk and stream it out the network. And then the CPU, same thing, would only have to be told when the transaction is complete. And this is probably several years away. And yes, there are lots of problems with implementing it. And yes, like the socket class, you know, even just the socket class, just moving the TCP/IP stack down to the host, down to the IOP, is a very, very difficult task because there are all sorts of little application level issues that come up that you have to deal with. Do you want to ask your question now?
Mm-hmm. Now it's CPU.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I can tell, some of the, you know, the EMC or NetApp boxes are pretty bloody fast already.
Yes, they are.
Static web pages. And they have essentially this architecture already with an embedded CPU doing all this. So why not just have two boxes? One of them is your static web server, and it's, yeah, it's completely I/O bound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it probably would be. Like I say, possible application. You know, this is one of the things that we brainstormed with, and we sort of looked at it and said, well, maybe, maybe not. You know, at the point when I left, it was still like, maybe not. But one of the things that's going to happen, though, let me go on to that, is things like InfiniBand, where you have very distributed I/O subsystems, and you're going to see intelligence moving towards the edges of the network, away from the center of the network. So I'm not sure, you know, if that exact application would come in, would actually be used, but I think you are going to see intelligence moving from just the centralized place on the network to different nodes and to the edge of the network. And is already a lot of that already happening?
I believe you want that. My company is But I have a question actually before you finish the last slide. What you've written there is very interesting, and it doesn't say PCI anywhere. How PCI specific is I2O? PCI is pretty big ball.
I2O is theoretically, I say theoretically, because it hasn't really been proven yet, but it's theoretically transport independent is what they call it. If you look at the stack, you know, there's an I2O PCI layer. In theory, since that interface between the PCI and the core is very clearly defined, you could pull that out and replace it with something else. You could have if you look at the I2O spec, it actually supports, for some insane reason, you can run I2O over PCI, ISA, EISA, MCA. You could even actually run I2O over SCSI, I believe, if you really wanted to. So, you know, you can replace that bottom layer with anything you want. And so that's, you know, when we talk about things like InfiniBand, basically, I don't know how many people have heard of InfiniBand. InfiniBand is a long-term replacement to PCI. It's a high-speed two-wire serial switch fabric I/O subsystem. I think it starts at 2 gigabytes a second, moving up. But it's been a while since I've looked at the InfiniBand details, so I could be wrong on that. But it's also a message-based I/O system. So in theory, you could take I2O and just replace the bottom part with an InfiniBand transport, and it would work. You know, and you're already beginning to see this increase in separation between I/O and data processing, things like network-attached storage. That's basically what you're doing. You have a box that does nothing but I/O processing. It gets, you know, requests for something and sends it out the network. And then, you know, also things like network processors. Intel has the IXP line, and I know there are a couple other companies working network processors. And then, you know, overall, I think there's a lot of interesting work ahead for the kernel hacking people. There's going to be a lot of really cool technology to play with in the next couple of years and to write drivers for and just have fun with. Really quick, some acknowledgments. Alan Cox for starting this Linux I2O development. The University of Helsinki for doing a lot of the I2O LAN work. Intel for funding me when I was working on this. And then several companies, Symbios, DPT, AsusTech, many, many others, who gave out hardware to both Allen and University of Helsinki for doing this I2O development work. And then some references. I guess all these references are on the paper, and I guess the papers are going to be mailed out to people later on, I heard. So you can get those from there. Questions, comments, flames? You could do that. Well, what I mean to say is, let's say you send a message to a LAN device and a block storage device. You don't know which one is going to get executed first, because within the I/O processor, you know, the way the threads are set up, one could have higher priority. However, because, you know, if you develop this card that has an I/O processor and then does journaling, let's say a journaling file system offload, you, as a developer, you would develop in such a way that when you get these messages, you always give certain messages higher priority and you force order. Because the device driver itself will force order. But it's the way that the messages get sent from the queue to the device drivers, which you don't have control over.
Sorry, I'm not talking about journaling file system offload.
Okay.
I'm talking about journaling file system running on the host CPU.
The host CPU and forcing order.
Right.
Yes. I believe it can still be done. It's been a while since I looked at the spec, but I think with the block storage class, there's actually a parameter that tells you what's the maximum number of entries you can have in the queue and still maintain ordering. But we didn't, you know, like I said, we didn't really play with that with Linux implementation right now because we didn't really need to at the moment. But I think you could still do it by having the request in a given order and then just not passing that limit. I have to look at the spec again, though.
Decent symmetric processing and a decent IO bus better as a
Symmetric processing, what was the second thing? A distant?
Decent
I/O bus. Decent. Right. Right, right. About that, yeah.
And as I was giving along the line, which is, well, PCI, if you really want to scale, do you really want to stick to PCI?
No, you don't. Which is, you know, like I said, InfiniBand is meant as a long-term replacement of PCI. The idea is, you know, a few years from now, when you get a server, it won't have a PCI, it won't have a CPU to PCI bridge. It'll have a host to InfiniBand bridge directly on that system. And in terms of symmetric processing, I personally think that's the way it's going to head. I think different people in the industry might think differently, but I know I can't really talk too much about it. But some of the I/O processors that we were working on as I left are the same speed as a normal processor. So you're seeing this move to like basically almost symmetric processing. Okay. Anything else? No more questions, comments? Okay. Well, that was what I had. Oh, that one.
Right ahead, make sure everything's finished before we go.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Yeah. Okay, that was all I had. Thank you very much.